Guest here, I just want to, if you haven't intuited this yet, this is the kind of space you don't have to stay in if there's any reason that you want to leave or need to leave. The bathrooms are over there. If you go that way, we'll all know where you're going. But that's how that works. And if there's any other thing, like whether it's an internal thing for you or an external thing, or if there's anything where you're just kind of like, yep, time to leave the room, this is not the sort of room where you have to stay, because there's some rule that says you leave when the preacher says we're done now. Okay? It's not that kind of space. So I want you to be part of the conversation because you choose in. And to stay in the conversation for the same reason, not out of any other kind of compulsion. And there are some other things that might compel us to be part of a conversation like this. And they have weight to them, as they ought to. And Donovan has mentioned a couple of flashpoints, and I'm going to, from the past week, that would be really, I think, legitimate points of entry for our conversation this morning, but I'm going to get to those in a moment. But let me just, a brief introduction, because I'm talking about you like we all know who you are, and that might not be true. Adrian, I'm just starting to get to know Adrian, and it's been a delightful initial journey for me. So I hope this is a journey that we get to continue together in different ways. I've gotten to know you, Adrian, primarily in connection to your work at Sandy Solo as the keeper of the circle there at the Spiritual Center, and also as a guest in the work that I do at Booth University. But you do many other things, and you are more than what you do. And so why don't you just take a few minutes and introduce Adrian the way that you think about and communicate about who Adrian is, and then we'll kind of get into substantive themes.
Yeah. First of all, I just want to acknowledge Ramona Pauls and how, through the ministry that she works for, that these doors were opened to you here. And when I looked around, I think I've seen some of you before in other settings, so that's good. When the children were here making noise, it was music to my ears. I pastored for a number of years, and I always tried to convey to people that the sound of children is not a distraction. The sound of children is the sound of life. So, you know, that's just a good thing to have in the midst of your group. I have two grandsons, 7 and 4. And so when I hear them or see other kids here, I really am reminded of them and thankful for the, our people call the future generations, faces that come from the ground. So whenever I see anybody, I'm beginning to think in terms of that your face came from the ground, from some ground, somewhere. And it's just a demonstration of the truth of Scripture that says our bodies are made of the dust of the ground. So I am from originally the Six Nations Reserve in southern Ontario. My clan name is Ganusano. It means deer lodge. I'm of the turtle clan of the Cayuga Nation. So I live as guest here in Treaty 1 Anishinaabe territory, especially in where our center is, by Beausejour. And as a guest, you know, there's different cultures right across the country, different protocols. Our people, whenever they meet, they meet in a longhouse, and we have fire that is in the longhouse as well. And we go in this direction around the fire. So when I come to Anishinaabe territory and they go this direction, I'm, as a good guest, I go in this direction. It's kind of like going into your home. If I go into your home, and then you tell me, Adrian, my home is your home. If you're hungry, go get something to drink. Here's where the stuff is, etc. I better make sure I'm in your home, because another home might say, Adrian, just tell us what you need, and if you want something to drink, we'll give you the options. We'll bring it to you and serve it. I have to keep the rules of the right house. So for me, it's like I'm very glad for this, the rules of this house, because it's very, very, very casual and relational, and I appreciate that much. My kids are five children. I've got my oldest is 29, and he's the father of the two grandsons. My youngest is 21. The two oldest are boys, followed by two girls, most beautiful girls in the entire world. And then my youngest son is 6'3", so he's taller than me. And so they're all in Ontario, between Brantford and Mississauga. And I'm working here doing ministry training for Indigenous ministry. It's a national school for the United Church, and I travel across the country doing things like this. And when we meet together and the kind of conversations we have, that's what I do all across the country. So glad for the open door to be here in your midst. So.
When I think of you in my imagination, Adrian, even though I've heard you kind of tell the intro part of your story a couple of times and talk about yourself as a father in terms of your role at Sandy Salo and those kind of things, partly because this would be the terrain, the house that I would feel most profoundly a guest in terms of your work, I think about your work as the keeper of the circle. Can you, just in a couple of minutes, can you tell us what that is, both as an idea and in your practice?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Within this part of the country, the term keeper is a common term used for different areas. So there are keepers of the land. There's among our people, there are keepers of the wampum that keep the history together. So the idea is that you have a responsibility given to you. And it's like all treaty relationships. It's all about responsibility. You have responsibilities. You have commitments in a treaty relationship. In the Western way of thinking, often there's the talk of rights and establishing rights, etc. And in our tradition, it's more of responsibilities. What are our responsibilities? So my job is to keep the circle, our circle of folks that are training in ministry that come to learning circles, just ensuring that there is a healthy environment there. Sometimes when I'm away, the mice play, and I hear what's going on, and then I come back there, and then all of a sudden, you know, things come back into order. So that's kind of my role there. But then we used to meet, our board used to meet at tables, and then we'd set up our circle for like devotional things. But we made the transition right to the circle for our board as well. So, and then people complained, said we need tables to put our computers on. They're called laptops.
Yes.
They're fitting right on your lap. But anyways. My job is to keep the health of the circle good.
Is there an Indigenous word for laptop? Anyway. this past few days, let's get into the deep end that I alluded to a moment ago. Just in the past few days, there's been these cultural flashpoints for long-standing, simmering issues in this continent. I was thinking about this morning on a drive-in, partly, and I was kind of wrestling in my own imagination with terms and what the words mean and how we should use them and think about them, because I had just heard the news story of the demonstrations this weekend, a couple of which I was alongside of, as well, response from the community to these two acquittals in a row and the murder of Colton Bushy and of Tina Fontaine. And one of the demonstrations was in Montreal, and one of the demonstrators there was carrying a sign that said, "Canada is a serial killer of Indigenous people." And so I was thinking, who's Canada in that sentence? Who's, well, the Canadians. What does that mean to be a Canadian? Because I think of you and I both as Canadians, but I think of myself as a Canadian who's understood that primarily in terms of dominion, both legally and otherwise, mm-hmm. And when I think about the way I've heard you talk about the history of Indigenous peoples in this land, we don't even have a first number for that. That's an old, deep, long story. And it's not the oldest story about the relationship between Indigenous peoples and those who see dominion as their God-given right when they roll around the world. How did we get here? By the way, that's the actual question. How did we get here? we're going to start talking about stuff that we don't have time to finish talking about, or even really kind of just do more than begin to open. So just be aware of that. So if you walk away frustrated feeling like, well, that didn't scratch the itch, good. Don't leave it to somebody else to keep scratching. Get it in gear. But let's get started. How did we get here?
Sure. Well, for me personally, 5 years ago, a good friend of mine passed away, Richard Twiss. And I really felt the loss of it because it was he was an older brother in the way my older brother wasn't. And so he meant a lot to me in life. And he passed away, and it touched me very deeply. But after 5 years, I've heard many people talk about the resolution that they find and move on. So the first of this year, I began to talk about that and releasing it. And things have felt very differently, and I'm not as sad as I was before. But in different ways, because of these last two acquittals, it kind of triggered a very deep and ancient pain. And like, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to really talk about the case itself. I can tell you, though, because I've had enough experience, that as they were reported on in the paper, the trials were reported, inside of me, I was already predicting the outcome. And I didn't ever want to acknowledge that. I did not. I said, the way this is going, it's like internally, I know what it's going to say, what they're going to say at the end. And even when the judge gave his instructions for this last one, I said, it's going to be pretty clear what the answer is going to be based on even that. And again, it's like I'm not trying to say anything about the legalities. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to argue with anybody about that. But there was an internal part of me that was saying, I know how it's going to go. And it has triggered a very deep and grief. And the reason it's deep is because it's longstanding. You know, that's the most recent thing. But, you know, we had justice inquiry 20 years ago, and Betty Osborne, and the same recommendations that were made then were made, you know, this or that would be made again, and have been said by folks. I did a report for the Christian Missionary Alliance, certain denomination that some of you might know of, and I put in this report in 1995 or 97, I think it was. I put in the report about 40 different recommendations, and they dealt with indigenous reality and ministry, etc. In 2006, Caledonia conflict in Ontario blew up. And great, you know, great kind of coverage and everything. And the official from over Canadian ministries and over Indigenous ministries in the Alliance came to Caledonia, sat down with me with an Alliance pastor and this Canadian official, who was the same official I gave the report to in 1997. And this was in 2007, so 10 years before. He said to me, after thinking about the Caledonia conflict, this conflict of land, he says, Adrian, what are we going to do? And I just very calmly said, 10 years ago, I gave you a report, and there were 40 recommendations in it. And I said, you can follow any one of them. And to me, that exactly is what the Canadian country does to our people. Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, many, many, maybe hundreds of recommendations. And then the Truth and Reconciliations are calls to action. We changed the language to say, let's quit talking about it and dreaming about it and planning for it. Let's do something. And I'm thankful that there's things happening across the country that are more action-oriented. But it's still, it's an ancient thing, and it's just the history been repeated over and over again. In Caledonia, you know, that was that piece of land that was blew up in conflict in 2006 was put into the legal system in a land claim in 1987. So it wasn't like we were just suddenly complaining about something. We were doing everything we could through the Canadian legal system to get the thing resolved. And then our land was being built on. So it's like community people said, you politicians, including our own politicians, aren't doing anything. We're going to stop it. Two ladies, Don Smith and Janie Jameson, said, we're going to go and we're going to stand in front of the bulldozers and we're going to say, stop. We've already told you that this is our land. They did that on February 28, 2006. And the folks, you know, to their credit, shut off their machines, didn't do anything bad to anybody, and left. But it's like, what do you do when, you know, if somebody keeps slapping you? What do you do?
Eventually you get pissed off, right? And either you lay down in a heap and you quit,
yeah,
or you push back, right?
Yeah.
But something has to give. You can't. That's not sustainable.
And the thing we do is that we put up with this for decades.
What? Back the truck up even further for us, Adrian. I'm gonna use we language for the European, those of European descent, the colonizers, if you will, in a broad stroke. And I realize if that stroke is too broad for you, let's chat. But what the hell do we think gives us the right to keep slapping? Where did that come from? Because mm-hmm. It's not from nowhere. It's not just hubris. It has roots.
Yeah.
What are the roots of that like staggering entitlement that mm-hmm. your people have experienced the way you just illustrated it?
Yeah. I've learned this in just observation of life in general. Whenever there's a conflict between peoples, there's the first thing that begins is a semantic war. And in the semantic war, whoever has the upper hand in terms of numbers tries to define the conflict and name the combatants. And so at Caledonia, they called us occupiers. And the reality was, in 1835, Canada occupied our territory and maintained occupation. They're the occupiers. Canada, the Canadian system, which includes the province and the crown. There is one crown in Canada, one in right of the provinces and one in right of Canada. They're the ruling authorities, and through their land system, they took our land. 1835. Now, today, whenever Canada makes a ruling on land issues, Canada references the 1835 ruling in the United States by Justice Marshall. In that ruling concerning a conflict with the Cherokee and the state of Georgia, Justice Marshall, Supreme Court Justice, cited the doctrine of discovery. And the fact that because of the doctrine of discovery, that the crown originally, the British crown, and then now the American state, have assumed authority over all of the lands, including the Cherokee lands. So then they could make a ruling and decide on Cherokee lands and send them west. They had the authority to do that. I have a guy that I heard, Robert A. Williams, who wrote a book called Savage Anxieties, The Invention of Western Civilization. And in this book, he's a Lumbee native from the Carolinas. He was educated in Harvard. He is at the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at the University of Arizona. And he wrote this book because he studies American Indian law. And he wanted to find out, where does doctrine of discovery come from? So as a lawyer, and as in English law, it's common law, so precedent. You always look for precedent. So he looked back in history and saw that Justice Marshall was relying on the papal bulls that gave England and Portugal, or Spain and Portugal, the right to claim land in North America. The French, you know, adapted that. The English adapted that. But it was basically the church saying, you can go and take the lands of any pagan. And if, especially if they don't convert, you can just go take all of their lands. Well, he as a lawyer, would dig back further. And he saw that when he got back further in the rationale, because it was the church was based on the Roman Empire and Latin language, he found that that doctrine of discovery was actually in the Roman laws. And as the lawyer keeps looking back, and he goes back, and he realizes that the Romans were appropriators. They didn't really invent a lot of things. They took the inventions of others, including the Greek understandings and Greek language and et cetera. They took a lot of ideas from there. And when he went back, he says the doctrine of discovery is actually articulated very clearly in the writings of Homer, the Iliad, all about the Trojan War, and the Odyssey, the return of Odysseus back to his estate. And he said, in that is the legal justification for the idea of taking other people's lands. The Greeks saw themselves as civilized. And as you moved away from the Greeks, farther and farther into the wilderness, you entered into savagery. And so there was, on the edges, were all of these savages. And in the ancient world, the idea of the savage was the Cyclops. Actually, it's also in Homer. The idea of the giant who has one eye, who looks human but not really, and who's a cannibal and unreasonable, and you can poke out his eye to save yourself, and etc. So there's these monster savages. There are also at the edges centaurs in the ancient Greek world, half human, half horse. So whenever horse societies come to those that don't have horses, they often mistake them as one kind of being. So this hybrid, they're strange. And then in that ancient Greek world was the Amazon woman, the warrior, the wonder woman, the woman with agency. And the Greeks were patriarchal. So nothing struck the fear into the patriarchal heart than an Amazon woman who could, you know, fight and stand up for herself and make decisions and function without a man's leadership.
So we're all feeling that right now, we being the guys in the culture. Let me just thank you. I knew that was in there, and I wanted it to come out, so thank you. So we're having this conversation. You just described a whole bunch of history, among other things. We're sitting in a gathering that we would use language like church for sometimes. And it's possible to just completely miss the connection between what you just talked about and religion and religious behavior. I was, we homeschool, and so one of the things that falls to me as a homeschooler at this point in my youngest's education, Taya's education, is we've been talking a little bit about the history of Christendom's sacred text of the Bible. The particular book we're using, I have to read pretty editorially because it has this perspective that I can't enter into all the way, but she knows that, so it's all out in the open. So we were just talking about, and this is related to the history part as it connects to the religious part, we were talking in particular this last week about the King James translation and how King James ordered that translation done because the Geneva Bible, which was already out there and doing a fine job, but didn't come from his government, had all these little side notes in it that actually assailed the divine right of kings. He wanted a translation that affirmed the divine right of kings, which is basically this idea that God gave you the power, so now you go out there and wield it in the name of God. This doctrine of discovery. Having stood personally in the room where Columbus was sent off by Ferdinand and Isabella and seen this huge tapestry that's on the wall of that room that is just such a... I want to be careful with my language because my feelings are super strong and y'all come here all the time, know what happens. But it's this freakish mashup of governance and the divine. It made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. I kind of, for the first time in my life, I felt like I had this experience of, oh, that's my legacy. Well, I don't want that, but I have it. So what do I do with it, right? Yeah. So, yeah. Excuse me. So that's this conversation in part. Yeah. And what you said about action, I want to shift gears a little bit because we're going to have more to talk about than we have time. One of the things you and I have talked about a little bit, Adrian, is the intersection between Christian spirituality, which would be the spirituality that most of the people in this room would be most familiar with. This is not an exclusive statement about this group, but I think it probably fairly represents the average in this room this morning, and an indigenous spirituality. And when you started to talk about that stuff with me, I remember saying this to you, I had that sort of same experience of that prickle, you know, this is important, but it wasn't like the one in Portugal. It was a positive thing. It sort of felt like, this is so timely. This feels like, I felt about that conversation that you and I had, like the first time I read Lewis's Space Trilogy, and felt like he was talking about postmodernity way before it happened in culturally defined terms. Just like, this is the right thing at the right time. And I know other people in this room have had experiences like that at a similar intersection. So, given what we've already talked about, that there are ways in which we can discern the roots of the systemic roots of this long-standing dilemma, for which a word like reconciliation is important but utterly inadequate, because we actually need a thing that's different than that, the thing that I've heard you describe as friendship. Could you talk a little bit about, take us from that indigenous picture that I've heard you describe so beautifully of the original desires that fueled and motivated indigenous people in their treaty making, and how that's connected to indigenous spirituality. In particular, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about the idea of the access that we all have to the eternal, but the way that we make something of it that's local, that has indigenous roots, that has ancient roots. Yep. That's a bunch, I know. Yep. But then I'll be quiet for a long time, and you just go.
Yeah. One of the things that I have in my possession is a two-row wampum. It is a beaded belt made of tubular beads, probably that long. And there are three rows of white beads, two rows of purple beads, separated by three rows of white beads, and then a second row of purple beads, and then three rows of white beads. And treaty making was something that we did before Europeans. We did that with each other as indigenous peoples. We came to agreements. And at the heart of this, if you, I wish I brought it. I'd taken it out of my bag here and set it aside because I wanted to put it into a special bag to keep protect it, and I forgot to bring it. But this belt conveys the idea of equity or equality, that there's a desire to respect each other. And so we had done that with other indigenous people, but then when the Dutch came to our territory, and the Mohawks were the most easterly one of our nations, and they were at the end of the Mohawk River as it goes into the Albany River, or the Hudson River, rather, at Albany, present-day Albany. That Hudson River goes down to Manhattan. And Manhattan, New York City, used to be New Amsterdam. because in the early 1600s, the Dutch were the world power when it came to colonization. So they came with economic desires. They wanted to trade. They wanted the resources. And so we negotiated with them in 1613. So this is the 405th year anniversary of that agreement. And we made this belt to commemorate our understanding of our relationship. And we heard what they wanted, and then they heard what we desired. And then we created this belt, and then we conveyed, this is how we can get along on the land. The white belt represents the river of life. So it would literally have been the Hudson River or the Mohawk River. They came up in their vessels, their European vessels, sailing ships. We went up and down in our canoes. So each of those dark rows represents the each of the nations. And then we had the three rows that were in between the two nations. The very first one was the desire for friendship. And when the Dutch talked money, we talked friends. We said, we want to be friends. And you know, a lot of people, even right now, you know, with all the raw feelings about indigenous, justice, etc., people ask the question, what can I do? What can I do? What should I do? Well, the very first thing that our people said to the Europeans was, we want to be friends. So if we want to be friends, that's pretty easy to figure out.
Unless you're looking across the table and you're seeing a savage.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
That's why I wanted
the
roots. Okay, keep going. I just wanted to make that clear.
And the difference was, here is somebody who sees a brother. We've always seen you as brothers. It's this idea that's in all of your education, because you have Greek philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, all of those guys. You have Greek lawgivers, Lucretius, and all of those people in your education, and you study them in university. I know, I went to university, and I know those names, and I hear what they say. And they had a lot of good things to say, but they had in the middle of it the idea of the savage. And it's buried deep in your consciousness. I've had, and this is only anecdotal, so don't say I'm saying it about you. I know some folks. They're married to Mennonite, sweet Mennonite ladies.
There aren't any of those here today. They're all empowered Amazonian Mennonite ladies.
And this indigenous man, and this lady, this particular lady that I'm thinking about, she's popped out nine Anishinaabe Cree kids. So she's committed. She's not a peripheral. But the native man has felt this. When I talked to him about the idea of the savage, suddenly he felt, yes, that's what I feel. And it's not your fault. It's deep in your psyche. And that is why there is so much silence about indigenous issues. Because it's so deep inside of you that you have to fight against the mainstream to actually come out and say something. It's kind of like when, you know, you've heard the term about people when they're hurting and breaking down in relationships, especially the woman says, say something, say anything. Let me know that you're alive, that I'm visible and I'm here. And indigenous people are doing that right now all across the country. Say something. Are we here? Do you feel anything? Can you understand something of what is going on with us? Is there anybody that will hear us and put a hand on our shoulders or say something or stand by us? Because right now we're feeling a deep, deep sense of pain and loss and hurt, and it's ancient, and it's happened for decades, and it doesn't seem to ever quit. It seems as fresh and new today as it was years ago. And what a lot of people do, they hear that and they're moved by it, but there's something holding them down. What's holding you down is this idea of the savage. That's why you can't look across that indigenous community and say, friend, 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 real good friend. Don't know them yet. Friend. You know everything about friendship. In high school, it's keen. You just exactly know. You know, friend, friend, enemy, double enemy, friend, friend, you know. So that was the first desire. This idea of friendship. And some people today are saying, indigenous people are just, they're so pissed off. And I mean good, educated people who have stood at the forefront and talked about relationship and reconciliation and trying to make things work. People who have invested their lives into it, who are just throwing up their hands and they're saying, it is a hopeless task and we're totally giving up on that. And I know what that feels like. It's just like, what's the use? Because what's changing? Not very much. You know, I went to the march on Friday at the law courts and then over to Odina Circle at the Forks. And I said, I wish my kids were here, all the ones I mentioned. And then I said, and I wish my in-laws were here because I married a non-native Canadian English person. That's what would have been meaningful to me. That's what would give me hope, actually. My people give me hope all the time. That's why I don't give up. When I think of the indigenous community and my friends and the people that are working on our behalf and the allies that are sticking their neck out all the time, I have a lot of hope. It's the silent. Martin Luther King talked about the moderate Christian and the one who was silent, who never said anything and never joined in the struggle, who philosophically believed that he was right but never said a thing. And that's what friends do. My friends rally around me even when I make my mistakes. Why do we have to be perfect to have a friend? Because that's what friendship is all about, a desire for friendship. And so some of these folks said, reconciliation, we never were friends to begin with. The Greek word for reconciliation means to make friends again. How can you make friends again if you never were friends in the first place? You were always deemed a savage. That's why the residential school system went on so long. Because, you know, it didn't matter what happened to our people because we were savages. That's why there's so many missing and murdered indigenous women, because they're savages. That's why you know, systems felt comfortable of taking an indigenous person in the middle of winter in 30 below weather and dropping them off in the country, you know, because they're savages. And that is such a pervasive thing. It's in the root. And you know what? I have great, great compassion, because for anybody to see that and then to deal with that, that is a huge thing. And I commend you, even just to listen to what I have to say here, because it's not easy to address that. And it's like when I go back to my community, you know, we just do things together. When we have a funeral, 400, 500 people show up and we feed them all a hot meal. Even the poorest families do that, because everybody rallies around and says, we need our family and friends. When conflicts happen, people come across different lines. Churches, church folks come, and traditional folks who are anti-church come, and people who don't care about church or religion at all, one way or the other, they come because something matters to us together. That's what friends are. And it's kind of like as you're going through the struggles of life, when you look around, you see your friends. And what we want to do is see you. Because that's what a friendship is. And I love my friends. I love Steve Heinrich. He's a friend. He's a friend of mine. At Caledonia, the pastors there, we met the pastors of Caledonia, the pastors of Six Nations, the pastors of Caledonia, or New Credit Reserve, we all got together. And there were big conflicts with 1,000 on this side and 750 on that side, separated by riot police. And there were skirmishes and fights and things going on. And sometimes all hell breaks loose. And I was going down there one time to stand with our people. And one of my cousins, second or third cousins, friends of my kids, heard that I was going down to Caledonia. And they said, what are you going to do? Go bust heads? I said, no. I said, but if I see any elder being hurt, or any woman being hurt, or any child being hurt, I'm going to do my best to stop it. I work for Mennonite Center Committee Ontario. They asked me the question about violence. I knew it was coming, too. I know church history. I know, all of this.
Did you have the temerity to say, whose violence? How did you
answer the question? I said this, because they asked, what do you think about violence? What's your stand on violence? I said, if somebody did anything to hurt my daughters, I said, I would go there and would put an end to it as quickly as I can and do it in a physical manner as quick as I could. And if somebody gets hurt in that occasion, well, that'll have to happen. I says, because I don't think that's violence. I got hired.
Sometimes there's some wiggle room between ideology and practice, isn't there? There's an old, just a total aside, but there's an old Quaker Mennonite, I've heard this variously, joke about the pacifist person who lives in the countryside and hears someone breaking in downstairs and takes their varmint rifle down there with them and kind of looks around the corner at the thief and says, I mean thee no harm, good sir, but thou standest where I meanest to shoot. And that's sort of that same tension, a little different, moment. That theme of friendship in Wampum that you were talking about, it also had and has a distinctly observable spiritual expression in Indigenous practice that I know I've heard you talk about, as I said a little earlier, in terms of the access to the eternal and then the making of something local or tribal or whatever language we want to use. Can you just talk for a few minutes, because that's what we have, is a few more minutes.
Yep.
Can you just talk for a few minutes about the overlap of this profoundly West, like, again, 30-second joke about the guy who gets rescued from the desert island, right, and the people are like, well, it looks like you've built some things while you're here by yourself. It's like, yeah, that was my house, and that's my church, and what's that other building over in the jungle? And the guy says, that's the church I left. Like, but he's all by himself. Like, there's this thing, sorry, it's old pastor jokes, but they're still good. So the point of that one in the context of our conversation today is, of course you left, right? Because it was all about what was inside the circle, and as soon as something joggles that circle, you got to respond to that as though you need to go make another exclusive circle or tribe. And we do this religiously all the time. We being the Europeans in particular in this particular dialogue we're having this morning. What's the intersection between that religious inclination, which again in this context you can kind of go, oh yeah, that's about civilization lives here and everything else needs to be civilized in religious terms, and a different idea than that entirely about the way that we would live out our spirituality.
Right. when God created us, he made us out of the dust of the ground and then breathed into us the breath of life, put us in the garden to feed us from the ground. One little kid hearing me talk about how that our bodies come from the ground and our food comes from the ground, she says, does that mean that plants are machines that turn dirt into food? Grade four, I says, that's the most brilliant thing that I've ever heard. I'll use it from here on in. So I do. But the idea there was, we're connected to this earth. That's what a human is. Civilization does what it can to disconnect us from the earth. And in terms of commissions from God, he said, "Go and fill the earth." People started to do that. And I know this about language. If you separate people and don't have contact between them, eventually you'll have a differing in the language, just by separation. You'll have human genius enter into the equation, and a group will build a canoe, and another group will build a ladder, one to go in the water, one to climb a mountain. So there'll be new words. So human genius, just by separation, will create differing languages. And in just the passage of time, languages will change. People just speak differently as you go on in history. So that was happening right before the Tower of Babel. In the Tower of Babel, the leader there and the power center said, everybody's spreading out. The language is all being muddied and changed. We need to pull everything together. We need to focus everybody's attention on this tower. And we need to be of one language. So it was language police. Going against the natural direction of the Creator, who said, go and fill the earth. So the idea of being different is not a problem at all. It's actually the place of difference where dignity is found. So indigenous people around the world have learned to live in various ways reciprocally with the land, being able to survive. So that now the Christian mission of making disciples of all the nations has actually been co-opted by this doctrine of discovery. And instead of making disciples of Christ, they make people members of a community that is concerned about something other than filling the earth and being diverse and accepting. So I have problems even with the term Christianity and indigenous spirituality. Because in my mind, we are connected from the earth and our spirituality came from the earth. We're not disconnected from the purposes of God and whatever she was doing in the earth from the very beginning. So for me, I was taught when I first, considered Christianity that it was the white man's religion. And so it was, shunted aside in my mind. When I finally embraced, I found it was different than that. And what I learned from my elders was that nationhood for us means land. So Creator has given us land, just like Adam. Creator has given us language out of the land. So this land helps us create our language. Language leads to culture, or our way of living and how we function in the land. And because of community, we have a decision-making process that we all come up with. when Jesus said to make disciples of all nations, I don't think he meant, now go into all the world and steal their land. He didn't, like the leaders of Babel, say, go into all the world and destroy their languages and make them keep yours. He didn't say, go into all the world and destroy everybody's way of being in the earth and make them like you. And he says, and he didn't mean, go into all the world and destroy all of their ways of making decisions and let them make decisions like you do. Because ultimately in Revelation 21, when you see the city of God come out of heaven and it's on the earth and there's 12 gates, all of the nations go in there with their glory and their leaders. With their glory, that's their culture, their language, their way of being, and their leaders, that's their governance. What denominationalism does is say, it doesn't matter what your governance is, you must accept ours. And if they had come to Haudenosaunee people, and our women, through the clan mother, choose the chiefs. Men have a council, but it's the women that choose the chiefs. And to be a chief meant you're a voice of the community. And when you quit being the voice of the community and start being your own voice, the women warned you 3 times, and then they took your authority away from you. If the church had come to us and asked us, you know, a patriarchal church asked us, can women be pastors or elders? There wouldn't have been no question. We wouldn't have had any problem with that issue at all. That's your issue. That's a patriarchal issue. You know, if you want to wrestle through with that, go ahead. that's not our problem. You know, in the book of Genesis, it talks about the very first marriage. A man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. Didn't say anything about the woman leaving her father and mother and joining the husband. But the man leaving the father and mother and joining his wife. In the Haudenosaunee way, you are whatever your mother is. So it doesn't matter, you know, that you are of your mother's family. And the man leaves his place and entered into your communal home. And we didn't have violence against women, because if you messed around with a daughter in her family's house, you had everybody that's going to stop you. And so it just didn't happen. And children were most protected in that setting. Sounds like our way of doing marriage and living families is more biblical than this idea of, you know, what we heard from the West and from the church.
Yeah, but once we got you to speak English and wear shirts and go in clapboard churches and stuff, it got better, right? Yeah. Oh, man. Okay, there's so many places we could go, as I said before. We're going to just stop arbitrarily because I can't even begin to pull the threads together, and I don't feel like I have to. Let's just throw those all out into the conversation that needs to keep going from here and regard this as a contribution to that. Is that okay?
Good.
All right. Adrian, I asked Adrian about this before. He's going to hang around for a while afterwards. If you want to talk to him, please feel very free to do that. If you want to be in ongoing contact with him, you can just ask him what the best way is to do that, and he can help
you. And I'll have cup of coffee while that's going on, and hopefully my coffee breath will keep you far enough away
that you can only respond to the really serious people, right? And if you're a guest in this community, we're going to sing together a little bit. Part of what we'll share is communion. It just gets passed around. It's an open table. So if you're familiar with some practice that limits that, this is not that practice. Anyone's welcome. You're just as welcome to not partake. So it's just on offer. All right? Thank you all for coming. It's been lovely to share this conversation with this group of people. All right. Peace, Adrian.
Thanks.